This is an MP3 audio clip from the weekly People First radio broadcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
In our society today, smoking has been transformed into a deviant and marginalized behavior. Over the years, the medical legitimacy provided by research findings on the health impacts of passive smoking, secondhand soap smoke, has allowed tobacco control advocates to redefine passive smoking into what amounts to a combined moral and rights and scientifically based issue.
Tobacco denormalization is a concept that has been used to capture a variety of policies and interventions that influence social norms related to tobacco use. University of British Columbia medical anthropologist Kirsten Bell, along with four colleagues, has just published a paper about tobacco denormalization that examines the stigma that is now associated with smoking and reflects on the use of stigma as a public health tool.
And Kirsten Bell joins us on the phone today. Welcome to People First Radio, Kirsten.
Oh, hi. Thank you.
Your paper draws a comparison between two seemingly contradictory approaches, the destigmatization of drug use, such as alcohol, prescription, and illicit drugs, as being crucial for increasing access to health care and improving the health of people with addictions. And then the active stigmatization of smokers, which puts tobacco control policy in a radically different place from other emerging public health orthodoxies related to addiction. Tell us some more about the denormalization and stigmatization of smoking behavior.
As you pointed out, there is this very strong disconnect between policy in the area of addictions and alcohol and in the area of tobacco. And we have learned a lot of lessons about the problems connected with stigmatizing, for example, illicit drug use. And for some reason, in the area of tobacco, there is a sense that some of those lessons that we've learned in other areas don't necessarily apply to tobacco, or that even if they do apply, even if smokers are being stigmatized and discriminated against, that ultimately this is all helping to achieve the greater good of improving their health by getting them to stop smoking. And so certainly this was something that was of considerable interest to us and really drove our research in this area. And as a result of our research, we do have a number of concerns about the ethical, the ethics of denormalization policies, and also whether they're actually ultimately even going to be effective for reducing smoking prevalence beyond what it is at the moment.
Kirsten, you mentioned the problems that are connected with stigmatizing drug use. And you seem to suggest that the problems experienced by smokers might be different. What are some of the problems connected with stigmatizing smoking?
When we look at illicit, obviously illicit drugs are illegal, which makes them quite different from tobacco use. But of course, alcohol is a legal drug, and there has been a focus on destigmatizing problematic alcohol use. So in some ways, we do see the problems connected with both as being quite similar, in that what we increasingly see is discrimination against smokers and marginalization of smokers. And we can see this in a variety of contexts. One that concerns us is in the context of healthcare, because increasingly we find a lot of people discussing the idea that because smokers are doing something that's unhealthy, that this might negate their right to healthcare. And so in Canada, we have some evidence from the Canadian Lung Association's a study of physicians that indicates that many physicians, in fact, do think that smokers don't necessarily deserve the same rights as other categories of patients. And so there, I think the study indicated that almost a quarter of physicians felt that way. So, of course, one of the problems with that then is that people who have smoking-related health issues, whether it be possibly lung cancer or COPD, might be less likely to go to their doctors because of the concerns about the smoking-related stigma. So we do have evidence of things like delays in care seeking amongst people, smokers who have the symptoms of some fairly serious tobacco-related diseases. So that's one of our concerns. And of course, we do see discrimination against smokers being more explicit in the context of insurance policy and also even employment policies. So the World Health Organization has a policy of not employing smokers or people who use tobacco products. And the way they justify this policy is that they say, well, we don't want to normalize smoking by employing smokers. So here they're using denormalization as an explicit justification for discriminating against smokers. So definitely, from an ethical point of view, we have some concerns about that.
Kirsten, the paper also observes that there have been changes, obviously, in the social composition of smoking, and
yes,
that those changes have led to a focus on the most socially vulnerable members of our society. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So one pattern that we see quite clearly across the developed world is that the people who are more likely to smoke are people who are more socially and economically disadvantaged, and that pattern certainly holds true in Canada. So that basically, as you move down income levels, smoking prevalence doubles in Canada. And so if we look beyond that at particular communities like, say, Aboriginal First Nations or Inuit communities, smoking prevalence is even far higher still, so over 50%, and in some cases over 60 or 70%. And then if we break things down even further, we can see that for people with mental health issues, for example, so smoking is extremely prevalent amongst people with schizophrenia. So ultimately, obviously, Canada is a country that consists primarily of the middle class. And so if we're focusing just on absolute numbers, it's true that in terms of actual numbers, there are more middle-class smokers than there are low-income smokers. But our concern is that that these particular groups are being disproportionately affected by policy because smoking is so prevalent in these communities.
Mm-hmm. You've noted that research with so-called hardcore smokers has shown that they're more likely to be older, male, and disproportionately concentrated among economically disadvantaged and lower income groups. Tell us more about the hardcore smoker.
There has been quite a bit of research interest in this particular, and a lot of that research comes from the United Kingdom. But basically, this research indicates that particularly a proportion of working class smokers in particular, quitting becomes particularly difficult because they are more likely to be very, very heavily addicted to smoking, for example, and have been smoking for a very long period of time, among other things. And so questions can be raised about how feasible ultimately it is for people who are really heavily addicted to quit smoking. And so, I mean, one thing that we think is really important is that there is more attention paid to harm reduction approaches in the area of tobacco control in the ways that have increasingly been embraced in the area of other addictions. And so, of course, in BC, we do have a lot of interest and support for harm reduction policies in the context of addictions. But in Canada, there's a lot less support for harm reduction approaches to tobacco use, if we recognize that maybe not everybody can quit smoking.
Yeah, there's a definite gap in how people view cigarette addiction, for sure, in that context.
Yes, absolutely.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Kevin. I'm here with Jan. We're speaking with Dr. Kirsten Bell, a research associate with the Department of Anthropology at University of British Columbia. Kirsten Bell has just published a paper called Smoking, Stigma, and Tobacco Normalization, Further Reflections on the Use of Stigma as a Public Health Tool.
Kirsten, the National Post wrote an article about your paper and interviewed a number of individuals with things to say about the tobacco control, including a representative from the Non-Smokers' Rights Association, who was quoted as calling your research shoddy and said that you're parroting the tobacco industry's attempt to portray anti-smoking efforts as an attack on individuals. The exact quote is, "What they've done with this paper is mischievous and careless and ill-informed. These people have simply bought into the tobacco industry's mischief." Kirsten, what's your response to these criticisms?
Well, certainly no researcher likes to have their work called shoddy or mischievous, so of course we're disappointed with that response. Having said that, it wasn't altogether surprising. I mean, tobacco control is a very diverse, includes a very diverse range of people, from researchers to policymakers to non-smokers' rights groups, and a variety of other players. And unfortunately, in some sectors of the community, I think that there is this increasing mentality of if you're not with us, you're against us. And so basically, in that relatively small sector of the community, I think there's this sense that if you're not unquestioningly supportive of tobacco control policy, then it must be implicitly supporting the tobacco industry, or might even be supported by the tobacco industry. And so the automatic reaction then becomes to try and discredit the research.
Mm-hmm. Too black and white.
Yeah, absolutely. And so unfortunately, that sort of polarization I don't think is very helpful, because I think we really do need to be having engaged, critical discussion about mm-hmm. tobacco control policy, because we need to know ultimately whether policies are ethical and whether they're effective. And our we have concerns with denormalization policies on both of those fronts.
Mm-hmm. The publication of this paper will be followed by publication of your study, Every Space Is Claimed, A Smoker's Experiences of Tobacco Denormalization. And you interviewed 21 smokers and 4 ex-smokers with a range of backgrounds and a range of ages about the impacts of tobacco control policies on their daily lives.
Yes.
What did the participants in this study have to say about their experience of public space?
Basically, it was clear that for a small proportion of smokers in the study, and these were primarily people who'd recently quit smoking, they were quite supportive of denormalisation policies, and they did feel that they had helped them to quit smoking. And so it does seem to be the case. I mean, obviously, we've done a very small study. It's what's called a pilot study, which is really just exploratory, looking at doing a research study to see whether it might be worth doing a much larger study on this topic. And so we don't claim our findings are sort of representative. But certainly... our findings are interesting in that mm-hmm. for a certain group of people, it did seem to be the case that denormalization policies they thought were beneficial. But for the majority of smokers in our study, and many of these people we interviewed were actually didn't like the fact that they smoke and wanted to quit smoking, but for whatever reason didn't feel that they were able to. We did hear some kind of disturbing things, and particularly in relation to this sort of everyday censure and hostility that smokers receive, quite often when they're smoking in places where they're allowed to be smoking, like in outdoor settings, which was, I think, evidence of the fact that stigma in this case has led to things like marginalisation and discrimination. But some of the things that were also quite interesting and do raise questions about the effectiveness of denormalisation policies were that what we tended to find is that a lot of people had really internalised these negative attitudes about smoking and themselves, mm-hmm. but it seemed to be the case that this had led to a sort of sense of helplessness in their ability to quit smoking. And certainly there is some research from New Zealand that would support this idea that stigmatizing smoking can actually hinder people's ability to quit smoking, because it can make them feel very bad about themselves and mm-hmm. simultaneously feel quite powerless in quitting.
Well, and in some of the areas where it might be really important to take a good look at too would be situations where people have no control in their lives anyways. For example, yes. psychiatric units, old age yes. homes where people are in their 90s, have smoked all their lives, prisons, situations like that where it's yes. Perhaps inappropriate.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, many people talked about the fact that they were highly addicted to cigarettes, and many people had smoked for a very long period of time, and quitting seemed like an impossibility. And so the fact that, of course, then they're in an environment where they're being made to feel very bad about their smoking. And so the other very common pattern that we saw as well was that what denormalization, and this makes perfect sense when you think about it, but what denormalization policy policies have done is not stopped many people from smoking. They've just really changed the ways that they smoke, how they smoke, who they smoke around. And so a lot of people talked about how they just didn't want to have to deal with the hostility they received when they smoked in public. And so now they increasingly just were smoking at home. And so some people talked about kind of closet smoking, and that people would say things like, look, I just don't feel comfortable smoking anywhere other than my backyard or in my home because I get too much flack when I do it anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, one of the concerns that then raises is that what we know from the evidence on the health impacts of secondhand smoke is the studies indicate that those health impacts are greatest in the home. And if you're creating a situation where you're sort of forcing people to only smoke in their homes, then, of course, what that will do is increase the exposure of other people in the home because people have nowhere else they can smoke.
Exactly.
You've concluded that the voices of those affected by tobacco control policies, primarily people who are already socially and economically disadvantaged, are largely absent from policy-level discussions and decisions. What would that involvement look like if it were to happen?
I think it would be sort of invitations to smokers to be part of these conversations. I mean, I think one of the problems is that there aren't really smokers' rights lobbies in the way that there are rights groups. Like in Vancouver, we have the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, which is a group that consists of people who use drugs. Whereas there aren't really organisations that give voices to what smokers experiencing that have any legitimacy, because there are some of those organisations, but mainly they seem to be funded by the tobacco industry, and so those organisations don't really have any legitimacy. So I think that it really would be about explicitly inviting smokers to be part of the conversation. I was at a meeting once, a high policy level discussion in the UK about tobacco policy, and nobody in the room was a self-declared smoker. These were people working in tobacco control. And then somebody raised the question of, well, maybe we should have some smokers at the table to talk about their perspectives on this. And then somebody else said, well, why would we want to do that? These people have an addicted mentality. And so I think that, I hope that that's not a typical representation of things, but I think that sometimes there is this sense that we don't actually need to talk to smokers because we know what's best for them.
Kirsten, we have just a moment left. I'm wondering, is there anything else you'd like to add to our conversation today?
Just that I think it's really great that you've invited me on the show, and even though I don't like it when my research is called shoddy or mischievous or careless, I think it's really good that we start that people are thinking about these things and having conversations about them, because I think that it's really important for us to be thinking about our healthcare policies and making sure that they're ultimately doing what we want them to do. And that smokers themselves have an opportunity to be part of that discussion. So I think it's great that you've invited me on the show. So thank you.
Thank you, Kirsten. We'd like to thank you for taking the time to join us today and setting time out of your busy day. We really appreciated that.
Okay, no worries.
All the best.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. Dr. Kirsten Bell is a research associate in the Department of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia. The paper we've been discussing is called Smoking, Stigma, and Tobacco Denormalization, Further Reflections on the Use of Stigma as a Public Health Tool. It's been published in the journal Social Science and Medicine. A second article, based on the primary research Kirsten spoke about, is due to be published shortly in the journal Sociology of Health and Illness. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Centre Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society, CHLY, 101.7 FM, chly.ca, community radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of these organizations.